This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
There was a big protest this week. Oh, wait, you didn't hear about it? Well, we'll talk about that now on Tactics. Good morning. You are in the Situation Room. Welcome into Tactics this Friday morning. The weekend is upon us. Lots to look forward to. But it is good to be with each and every one of you this morning. And I've got to say, one of the stories that has baffled me this week, and I kind of saved it till Friday because I was really wanting to see if it would start to garner any steam or I would start seeing some reporting on it, and I was, well, not surprised, but I certainly, even though this was what I anticipated, there was a level of disappointment with this particular protest. So the protest, 200 high schools participated in it, about 80 colleges participated. So you would think, I mean, that's not massive, but certainly widespread, certainly enough to merit some news coverage, especially considering how much coverage they give to protest. I mean, with the March for Our Lives, especially the anti-gun protest that got wall-to-wall coverage on the media outlets, you would think because the left loves covering protest and because the media seems to absolutely adore, especially children protesting, high school students, college students, young people. I mean, college students, of course, would be adults, but they're still young individuals. You would think because they just absolutely love that and eat it up that there would be lots of coverage of these protests. So why is it that there was virtually no coverage? The mainstream media may have put up an article or two, but by and large, you weren't seeing a whole lot of coverage for it. You certainly weren't seeing the level of coverage that we've been seeing in protests the past few weeks. I wonder why that is. Well, it could be because this protest actually had nothing to do with guns. In fact, this protest was people marching out of class to protest abortion being legal. This was a sort of a miniature march for life, except the big difference, instead of it happening in D.C., it took place on college and school and high school campuses. So 200 high schools, 80 colleges, and a lot of those schools, which you would think this would make the story even more interesting, a lot of those schools were in California, a place where the mantra of the state is abortion on demand. You would think that that would help the story along, help it get some traction in the national media because it was centered around, it was started in, and it was primarily attended by Californians. And yet, you still got very little coverage on it. A lot of the coverage that I was looking at to do this story came from the Sacramento Bee, because there really just weren't that many news outlets that covered it. There were a few conservative news outlets that cover it. I try to, not because I don't like them, but I try to use as my sources for news coverage, avoid some of the more conservative news outlets just to give kind of a, well, for one, to increase my credibility with people on the left, even though they seem to not care even if the reporting disagrees with them when it comes from their own sources, but nonetheless. So you're looking into this particular protest that came out, and it started primarily with a teacher who asked about the fairness of the protest that did start with March for Our Lives, because the question that she asked, which was a legitimate question, and keep in mind she's a public school teacher in the state of California, so there were quite a few people of her, quite a few of her friends and colleagues in public education that vehemently disagree with her, especially considering she's in the state of California. And she asked, well, why is it that the school made it a point to go out of their way to help facilitate a political protest? In other words, they said to the kids, you're allowed to do this. In fact, there were some schools, she never mentioned this in the video that she posted, so I don't know if this was going on at her school in particular, but there were some schools that actually mandated kids leave class and walk outside to protest to help the optics of it. They actually made it because you can't just leave kids in a room by themselves, they said. So if you, whether you like it or not, whether you agree with the protest or not, you got to leave class and you have to go outside for the March for Our Lives protest. There were some schools that were actually not only looking the other way, but actually assisting and facilitating the protest. And this teacher asked what was a very good question. Would they be so gung-ho about helping out students wanting to get involved in the political process if that was political speech that a lot of them disagreed with? And she brought up, what if there was a march for life? What if for 17 minutes we had people just walk out to protest abortion? Would the school be as accommodating as they were with the March for Our Lives protest that happened a few weeks ago? It was a legitimate question, and it was a fair comparison. And what wound up happening, at least based on all the reporting that I've seen so far, is that the schools did try to give equal time. In other words, most of them did not try to prevent the March for Our Lives event, or did not try to prevent the March for Life if they participated in and helped facilitate the March for Our Lives. I think even they realized, and realized correctly, that they could not facilitate and or merely look the other way when it came to students skipping class on one protest if they were not going to do it for another. So I think even they realized that that was going to cause a stir if they tried to push back too hard on this. And so this teacher who asked that question, and then another teacher nearby, kind of helped organize this whole thing. And like I said, there were no reports of retaliation, but part of the reason that this was asked, and I think that it's a fair point to bring up, let's just say before the Parkland thing ever happened, before the 17-minute protest a few weeks ago took place, that they just sporadically come up with a March for Life that they were going to organize. Do you think that the school administrators and the teachers' unions and all of that would have been okay with students just up and leaving class for a little under 20 minutes in the middle of the day? Do you think that would have taken place? Do you think they would have been perfectly all right with that had this happened before Parkland? Let's just take Parkland out of it. Do you think that they would have been nearly as receptive to it as they were with the Parkland protest? I think anybody that's looking at this objectively, even if you happen to be on the left, would say, well, probably not. The reason that this protest with the protesting for gun control, the reason that it was as successful as it was is because, especially in states like California, school teachers tend to lean more towards the left, and this happens to be something that politically a lot of the people that would have had the ability to facilitate this agree with. It was a good point by the teacher, and I do think that it is encouraging to see so many young people go out and protest for life, protest against abortion, which, by the way, statistically speaking, if you're just looking at the numbers in the polls, the younger generation is more anti-gun control than previous generations and more pro-life. And so folks can talk about millennials and Generation Zers all they want, and you would think by the media standpoint it would be the exact opposite. You would think that young people are super pro-abortion and super anti-gun, but actually the reverse is true. Goodness knows millennials have their flaws and their problems, and I say that as one of them. But on those couple of issues, they're actually more conservative than their parents or their grandparents. You would never know that by looking at the media, but if you're looking at actual polls, ones that there was one that there were a couple that I'm referencing, Pew Research and Rasmussen put out polls on this, and the millennial generation is more pro-life and more pro-gun than the generations to come before. But much like this protest, that's not a headline you're going to see by the mainstream media. Now, a lot of people are saying that this is not a fair comparison to compare the issue of abortion to the issue of guns, and I'm going to answer that claim on the other side of this break, 860-1440, if you want to call in.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Sensible of the importance of Christian piety and virtue to the order and happiness of a state, I cannot but earnestly commend to you every measure for their support and encouragement. Governor John Hancock, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, those are the numbers if you want to call in. You can also tweet me at Tactics Radio if you're interested in doing so. And since we're talking about the phones anyway, let's go ahead and jump to the phones. Let's go to John from Millbrook on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I wanted to at least weigh in on the two subjects that you're paralleling here.
Uh-huh.
You know, you have the, I guess you called it the pro-life people, and then on the other side, the Right for Life.
It was March for Our Lives. It was the anti-gun protest.
Right, it's anti-gun. Yeah, that's true. And you talked about the comparisons between the two and how they ought to. I just thought about something. Being a pro-lifer myself, for sure. Maybe what we ought to do in that movement is go after the instruments.
Right. We should
and the sucking machine and all that horrific apparatus that they have to do to carry on the procedure. And that would be about the same thing, wouldn't it? Because in the other movement, you're going after the inanimate object.
Right. It would be like if we blamed forceps on cause of abortion.
Right. And everybody would agree that that's ridiculous.
Well, of course they would. It makes no sense.
Because let's say we wanted to ban all forceps, okay? Now, forceps are used for a lot of good things, too.
Oh, absolutely. They're medical instruments.
Great procedures, that kind of thing. But in this instance, of course, it's killing of an innocent life, as most reasonable thinking people are aware, and that's their view. But it would be the same kind of thing. And I, you know, it's a shame that, you know, we have to go that far to show how ridiculous the issue is when you start talking about pro-choice and that kind of thing, because it's the person that's to blame is the doctor, and in abortion is the doctor, and in particular the person that is going to have the abortion.
Right. I mean,
and in the other situation, it's the person that's taking the gun and going to use it.
Well, and that's really the issue, is that when you're talking about any issue and you talk about it in terms of morality, regardless of what it is, you have to focus on the person, because it makes no sense to make the argument that an inanimate object is either moral or immoral when it can't make choices by itself. It cannot mm-hmm. act on its own. And
yeah,
so because of that, arguing that the inanimate object is part of the problem makes no sense.
No, it doesn't. And I hope that maybe the young people one of these days will overcome the failings of my generation and others, and we'll start to see the light on how cruel and inhumane and the destruction of innocent life is, and maybe perhaps in your lifetime, maybe that thing will be overturned.
I certainly hope so. I think that a lot of that is going to depend on the Supreme Court. A lot of it is going to depend on where we go from here, but public sentiment has been dropping in terms of approval ratings for abortion being legal since, I believe, the trend started in 1992, and it's been trending downward ever since. So it is working at a slow pace, but there has been a decrease the further time goes on. And I really do believe this, that maybe about 40, 50 years from now, when I'm, you know, if I'm still alive and still kicking back then, I will be about 80 years old, that history will look back on that time the way that our generation looks back at, for example, the Jim Crow laws, and how idiotic and backwards thinking that was.
I still think, and one of the biggest things is the ultrasound video, when you consider that alive in the mother's womb, I think that will have an impact.
I do too, and for those of you that are having a little trouble hearing, because you're breaking up a little bit, John from Millbrook, so I do appreciate your call, but I got to let you go. The phone's getting pretty rough over there. I guess you're in a bad spot or something, but when it comes to that, that's a really great point. And I do think that is really a big part of what's going on and the reason that you're seeing this movement from people, especially in my generation, because like I said, that trend started back in 1992. That's really when you saw a significant decrease of adults, voting age adults, in their approval ratings of abortion. Now you ask yourself why. Well, especially with a statistic like that, it's almost impossible to point to one particular factor, and you have to be honest with looking at that. But one thing that I think made a very large impact, and John from Millbrook just brought it up, is that's the time that the generation that their very first baby pictures were ultrasounds, pictures of themselves in the womb, when people started being able to see themselves in the position of being the unborn. That's really where the decrease happened, because up until 1992, from the point of about Roe v. Wade, the time that that Supreme Court decision was enacted, from that point up until 1992, you see an upward trend. It either goes up or remains stagnant pretty much the entire time between then and 1992. Then in 1992, all of a sudden you see a downward trend, and it's been trending downward, albeit slowly, but it's been trending downward in public approval ever since. And you ask yourself, why then? Why was that the point? Well, look at what happened 18 years before 1992. So if you bring it back, and you bring it back, that would be 18 years beforehand would be that would have been in the 70s when ultrasound technology really started taking off. It started becoming common, because they had it beforehand, but it became common in hospitals. And so the average person was able to see ultrasound pictures, able to see sonograms. And nowadays they've got it to where you can do it with 3D rendering. And I mean, it's basically the next best thing to being inside the womb yourself. It's almost like having a little camera in there, because of how good the technology has gotten. And because of that, the average person could really see themselves inside the womb. They could see themselves in the position of being unborn, and they make that connection to it. And I really do think that that was probably the single biggest factor, if I had to guess, on what started this trend and really helped see the barbarism and the cruelty that is abortion for what it is, the killing of an innocent child. Because that's what we're really talking about.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. And NewsRadio1440.com, 860-1440. Those are the numbers if you want to call in, if you want to talk to me. You can also tweet me at Tactics Radio. And one of the things that I talked about a little bit ago, and I do want to give a payoff here to that, because I did promise to talk about it, and I do think that this is a issue worthy of discussion. A lot of people on the left, because there have been comparisons and because this protest was done largely in response to and as a reaction to the March for Our Lives, the big anti-gun protest that was going on, a lot of people are saying that it is unfair to compare the issue of abortion to gun control, that this is not a fair comparison, these are apples and oranges, and because of that, you ought not compare these two issues for whatever reason. And people on the left are saying that I actually agree. I think that it is not fair to compare the two. They are not the same. And there are several reasons that are not the same, but not for the reasons the left is saying. And I'm going to break this down real quick. First of all, there are several differences. And there are several differences that are significant that shape the way that people think and ought to think about these issues. So what are the differences? Why is this not a fair comparison? Well, for one, because there is no amendment protecting a right to abortion. Even some of the justices that were in the prevailing decision in Roe v. Wade basically admitted that they made up the right to privacy out of whole cloth. It's never stated in the Constitution. It's never presented. There is a privacy in your personal effects. We get that from the Fourth Amendment, for example. But the right to privacy, which at best would have been a technicality, even if it did exist, was basically made up right from the start. But with firearms, with the right to keep and bear arms, that's in the Constitution. It is clearly stated. It's not obscure. It's not difficult to understand. It says very clearly, shall not be infringed. Not a lot of wiggle room in that. And so the Constitution, literally the Second Amendment, in other words, there's only one that they viewed as more important than that. It is the Second Amendment. It is the second thing that they put in there that was like, you know what? The government really ought to be protecting this. Now, there are five rights guaranteed by the First Amendment, but the Second Amendment saying all five of those things, those are the most important. But right after that, when it comes to importance, firearm ownership. Well, not firearms specifically, but arms of some kind of weapon, the ability to defend yourself. That's second most important in the minds of our founders. And so you're right. It's not a fair comparison when it comes to that, because the right to keep and bear arms is a constitutional, God-given right. The quote-unquote right to abortion was basically made up by the court out of whole cloth, and it's something that the founders themselves vehemently disagreed with. Several of them voiced this specifically. Several of them didn't, but there were laws against abortion on the books in many of their states, and they never voiced any kind of disagreement. So we can assume that at least the majority of them, being statesmen and being aware of their state's laws, would have approved of them by not seeing them not bringing up the issue there, that being part of British common law. And so there is a big difference in the two issues right there. Also, abortions are far deadlier. They are far deadlier than guns. And if you don't believe me, let's look at some of the statistics here. I'm pulling this primarily from the FBI crime statistics. So if you're looking at 2016, which is the last year we have statistics for the FBI, it takes them a little time to gather everything and put this out. And so 2016 is the last year that we actually have the numbers for when it comes to total homicides, firearm homicides. So if you're looking at total firearms, that is 11,004. 11,004, that is the total in the entire country. And keep in mind, we're in a country of 320 million. 11,000 total firearm homicides, which accounts for a little under three quarters of all homicides. And so you're looking at that, and then you compare that to abortion. In 2016, same year that we're looking at when it comes to the firearms, there were 893,000 children murdered in their mother's womb. 893,000, according to the Center for Disease Control. So you're looking at that. Let's compare these two, because we want to compare apples to apples. That means per day, there were 2,446 children killed in the womb in 2013 alone. And that's, frankly, a little conservative. It's a little bit of a conservative estimate. So it actually the actual numbers are probably a little bit higher, according to the CDC. Okay, you compare that to total firearm homicides per day, that's 30. Still way too many. Still horrible that that's taking place. And here's another thing you have to keep in mind, too. Those are firearm homicides, not firearm murders. So that's not only including, and I used homicides for a reason instead of murders, that's not just including when somebody else intentionally shoots somebody else with a gun. That's also including any kind of accident, something like that. It doesn't include suicides because that's a different qualification, and it should be a different qualification. But when it comes to homicides, that's some kind of man-caused death with a gun that would exclude suicides because that's a different classification. So you look at that, 2,000, almost 2,500 a day when it comes to abortion. When you're looking at firearms, even including the accidents, even including when people get their hands on guns that aren't supposed to and wind up hurting themselves, even when you're talking about mass shootings, even the shooter, you know, if he gets shot, for example, in exchange of gunfire, something like that. So even this would even include deaths where a good guy shoots a bad guy with a gun, even lawful homicides. Even if you're including all of that, it's still only 30 a day. Now, I wish that we could decrease that. I'm not saying we shouldn't take it seriously, but if you're comparing the two, abortion is many, 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 many times deadlier than firearms. So there's really no comparison there, and the left is right to say that this is not a fair comparison. Abortions are far deadlier than firearms are. Also, here's another thing. Abortions cannot be used defensively. Because like I said, in the stats I just used with the total firearm homicides, that also includes when a civilian shoots somebody to defend themselves. That's not the case with abortion. In abortion, a life is lost every single time an abortion takes place. Every single time. Whenever an abortion takes place, somebody innocent dies. When you're talking about firearm homicides, some of those are good guys killing bad guys that would have hurt more people had they been allowed to continue on. That's not the majority, probably. There's not really a breakdown in the FBI statistics for that. But the difference is firearms can be used defensively. Now, the same CDC that I'm drawing the abortion records from, that I'm pulling those stats from, they engaged in a 2013 study into defensive gun use commissioned to them. And the thing about defensive gun use, it's always hard to get stats on this. And you understand why, because you're essentially trying to gather up information and gather up data on a non-event. So, for example, when somebody wants to rob someone, wants to take their wallet, and what they do to that end is pull out a gun on them and shoot them and take their wallet from them, it's very easy to get a record on that because you have a death, you have a report. But when something's used defensively, you may know about it. It may not get reported. And so it's really hard to gather stats on this, but the CDC did the best that they could. And based on the information that they found, they said it was, and this is the reason that it's hard to get stats on this. This is part of the reason that there's such a big gap here, that there's a big variation. It's probably closer to somewhere in the middle. But they found that there were anywhere between 500,000 and 3 million cases of defensive use of firearms, so lawful defensive use of firearms, deterring a crime or deterring someone from getting hurt, a year. That is anywhere from, if you're using the conservative and versus the highest possible statistic, that's anywhere between about 1,300 per day and 8,000 per day. So if you're looking at that and looking at that compared to the total firearm homicides, like I said, all firearms, that includes handguns, shotguns, whatever, only 30 per day in the entire country. Still too many, still something that we should work on if at all possible, because there's a lot of gun crimes in there, and that's something we can work on. But if you're comparing that to how many times a day a gun is used defensively, that's 30 versus, even if you're using the most conservative estimate, 1,300 per day. So if you're looking at that compared to gun homicides, that is 45 times more. You get 45 times more defensive use of firearms than you do having some kind of gun homicide, which, again, that homicide number also includes when someone is shot in lawful defensive use of a firearm. If you're looking at the highest possible defensive use statistic that the CDC puts out, that's 273 times. So you're 273 times more likely in that particular scenario, if that number happens to be closer to the truth, you are 273 times more likely to use a gun to defend yourself than you are to be killed by one, even if you're including accidental gun deaths. You're at least 45 times more likely if you're using even the most conservative estimate that the CDC produces. And so that's one big difference, is that they actually can be used in a defensive manner. So let's look at that. Just to give you some kind of idea about that, when you're comparing total firearm homicides to other methods of killing someone, if you're looking at the total stats, keep in mind that if you're looking at all firearms combined, that's about 11,000 of the homicides. Knives are 1,000, about 1,600, and hands, feet, and fist, oddly enough, is 656 per year. Now, I want you to think about that. Because if you're comparing that to mass shootings or school shootings, which these protests were centered around, there are only 80 deaths in 2016 for mass shootings. And that was actually a pretty big year because that was also the year of the biggest mass shooting that had taken place up to that point, Pulse Nightclub, with the 49 people that perished in that particular shooting. So if you're including all school shootings, or sorry, all mass shootings for 2016, you get 80. 650 were fist, hands, and feet. So you're more likely to be punched to death than to die in a mass shooting. And yet we're letting that incredibly small statistical outlier determine our ideas and where our laws are going to go when it comes to firearms and firearm safety. And it's even worse with school shootings. Now, granted, 2016 was actually kind of a quiet year for school shootings. We didn't have nearly as many deaths in school shootings as we normally do because we're averaging about 10 a year. But there was only one in 2016. But even if you're going with the average, because that was kind of a low year, if you're going with the average, we're averaging about 10 deaths a year per year. And so we've got about 10. That still means that you are about 65 times more likely to die by someone punching you to death than you are being shot in a school shooting. And so the idea that that ought to be determining where we go with gun control, because it's just such a statistical outlier. It's so incredibly infinitesimally small when you're looking at a country of 320 million. Not saying it's not something that we shouldn't take seriously. Not saying it's not an issue that we should be concerned about. I'm just saying, to put it in perspective, this is an event that does not occur all that often. And so there's so many ways that that is the case, and it makes no sense to use that as the basis of the argument that we're talking about. We've got a few more stats to go through and a few other ways that firearms are not at all a fair comparison to abortion, and we'll get to that in just a moment when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The best friend to American liberty, who is the most sincere and active in promoting true and undefiled religion, and who sets himself with the greatest firmness to bear down profanity and immorality of every kind. John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, those are the numbers. For those of you just now joining us, what we've been talking about is there are a lot of people on the left that are claiming it is not fair to compare the abortion and the gun control issue, which is something that I know this surprises a lot of people, but I agree with, but not for the reasons that they're saying. So when you're looking at this, one of the big differences is that when used correctly, guns save lives. When used correctly, abortion ends life every single time. So a gun can be used to end a life too, that is correct, but only when used incorrectly. That's a outlier. That is a flaw in something that, in the process that takes place where people are supposed to be able to use guns to defend themselves, as a backstop against tyranny, so on and so forth. Many, many reasons to own guns, but my point is there is a correct way and an incorrect way, and what we're talking about is we're only looking at the way that they are used incorrectly. With abortion, when done correctly, when an abortion is successful, a life is ended every single time. And so it's not right to conflate the two for that reason alone. Also, and this is one of my big pet peeves, the government does not give $500 million, $500 million to Smith & Wesson or Walther or Winchester or Remington every single year to produce guns. They do give $500,000 to Planned Parenthood. And if you're looking at the statistics there on abortions, the total abortions, like we talked about, 2016, 893,000. If you're looking at just the abortions Planned Parenthood did in that year, That's 321,000. So 36% of all abortions, a little over a third of every abortion in the United States, was performed by Planned Parenthood. And yet they're getting $500,000 of money from us to continue to facilitate that. Even though the Second Amendment is a constitutional right, you don't see the federal government paying for my pistol or my shotgun. And yet with this, we're actually funding abortions with taxpayer money. And so that's another reason that it's not fair to compare the two. And if you're looking at how deadly those are, again, just Planned Parenthood, if you're just counting Planned Parenthood, and you look at that versus the total homicides with guns, that means you are 29 times more likely to be killed by Planned Parenthood than you are a firearm in the United States of America. And again, that's even including accidental and everything else. So even by using the most conservative statistics, you are far, far more likely to save a life or protect yourself with a firearm, and you are far more likely to die at the hands of Planned Parenthood, just Planned Parenthood alone, not even counting the other two-thirds of abortions. You're 29 times more likely to die at their hands than you are gun homicides. You're 81 times more likely to die by abortion in general than you are to be killed by firearms. And so you're right, it is not a fair comparison. Also, even if you believe that abortion is legal, which I completely disagree with, that is not an excuse to use taxpayer money to fund it. And it's clear that Planned Parenthood, even by themselves, are far deadlier than any gun. And that's the thing. Morally, guns can be a positive or a negative, but abortion is always evil. One is an inanimate object, the other one is a choice. Hour two coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Well, we haven't bombed Syria yet, so that's good. We'll talk about the latest on that on Tactics. Welcome back. You are listening to the second hour of Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with me, or you can tweet me at Tactics Radio. Either way, feel free to comment on the show through those mediums. And I gotta say, I always do the best that I can to lead with my mistakes, and this is why I ask you guys over and over again to keep me accountable. I had a caller buzz in and say that I accidentally said $500,000 to Planned Parenthood. And what I meant to say, I just misspoke. I know the stat, but it's actually supposed to be $500,000,000. I said $500,000,000. It's supposed to be $500,000,000. I said $500,000,000, because it's $500 million. And so I just, you know, got the words mixed up in my head, which I'm not perfect. That happens. So I do appreciate the caller bringing that to my attention. I do apologize for that. And if I do make mistakes on the air, I am perfectly okay with someone calling up, pointing it out on me. That happens. And like I said, that I'm far from perfect when it comes to this. And as much as I talk, as much as I'm on the air, I'm going to make mistakes. So by all means, point it out if I do or say something inaccurate on the show. But nonetheless, we are going to move on. I guess it's a good thing that we haven't bombed Syria yet. I'm trying to sort through it because I do think the United States needs to respond and respond very strongly. There was a lot of speculation earlier this week, that when it came to Russia, we were worried about bombing Syria because Russia had promised retaliation of their own military action against the United States if we were to act. And I think that was part of the reason that we had not done anything. There were a lot of reports of Russian operatives and Russian military operations going on in Syria, that a lot of Russians were moving around and pulling back. And so a lot of people speculated, and part of this could have been because of the tweet, Donald Trump tweeting out that Russia, that bombs were coming towards Syria and they were going to be coming hard and smart and all this stuff, which don't know that that's necessarily the right way to talk about an event that would kill people like that. I do think that if nothing else, because of the cost of human life, even in this case, what would probably primarily be evil human life, there still does need to be a certain level of respect for that and respect for the gravity of that situation that, unfortunately, I don't think the president showed. But, you know, I don't think it was a huge deal, but I do think that there was a more delicate way to put that that would have been more effective. But because of that tweet and because of some other things, it was obvious that Russia was preparing for the possibility that the United States military makes another action against them because of the chemical attacks going on in Syria. And so looking at that, I will say that even though I was a little critical of the PR standpoint and the way that the president handled that, it looks like because we haven't bombed Syria yet and because we're talking to our allies right now, we're trying to build a coalition, it seems as though the White House is actually taking this very seriously, which is a welcome approach. They are thinking about this. They are contemplating all the options, all the angles. At least that's what it appears to be for me looking from the outside looking in. That's the reason that they have not gone ahead and bombed some military targets in Syria to make a point. It appears as though because they understand that the repercussions with Russia will be severe, that they are at least contemplating and looking at all their options. Now, I do think that the military needs to respond. When the president makes a promise, that needs to be something that people can count on. People need to be able to look at that, and when the president says something and when the United States says that we are going to respond, like Nikki Haley did at the UN, like the president himself has pointed out that we plan on doing, that needs to be something that is backed up. What we don't need is somebody like President Obama who says that he's going to draw a line in the sand and then draws that line and then they cross the line and he backs up and threatens to draw another line. That doesn't work. And that's ineffective. And part of the reason that I think, as far as our foreign policy goes, the reason that Russia and other countries just absolutely walked all over us with the Obama administration is because they knew he wasn't going to do anything. They knew that, by and large, the president was not going to respond or act based on that. Now, he did respond to, and there's the war in Libya that we really don't even talk about much that he got us into and continued in many respects, not all of the policies of the Bush administration, but the wars of the Bush administration, at the very least, with Iraq and Afghanistan. Again, I'm not criticizing, I'm not saying that that was good or bad one way or the other, I'm just stating it as a fact that that did happen. And so, Obama did tend to not have, you knew that his threats were basically empty threats, and that was really the issue that you're getting to. With Trump, that's not necessarily the case, he's proven that in the past, but I am appreciative that it at least the appearance is there, that the White House is taking this very seriously, and they should take it seriously. When it came to Russia, Russia's taking it pretty seriously. Russia, just a couple days ago, announced on their TV networks, because keep in mind, in Russia, the government runs everything. And so they announced through their TV networks that Russian citizens needed to be prepared for the possibility of nuclear war with America. And so they've been talking about fallout shelters. They've been talking about what they're going to do, what they're going to need to do in terms of food preparation, that kind of thing. And so Russia is battening down the hatches and they're getting ready for an open conflict. Now, is that going to happen? I don't know. I hope not. I hope that we don't wind up in an actual war with Russia. That would not be desirable for any of the parties involved. Hopefully it doesn't come to that. I hope that it doesn't. But my point is, Russia is taking this very seriously. The UK is taking this very seriously. Because you remember what kind of, I think, got the ball rolling with the UK being so serious about this was when 21 of their own citizens were killed by Russia on their soil with a chemical agent. And so because it's chemicals specifically affecting this and because it's Russia involved in backing the Assad regime, because of that, the UK is taking this pretty seriously. I got to tell you, I was looking for references to this story a couple nights ago when the story initially broke, and all of the top results, all from the UK. The Guardian, Daily Mail, all these news websites on the UK, America barely covered it. And this is one problem that I have with the media and what I think a lot of people have with the media. We are literally on the cusp of a conflict, an open conflict with Russia, where one wrong move could trigger an actual nuclear war. And the media can't talk about it because they can't spare the time. They're too busy talking about James Comey and Stormy Daniels. That's at the forefront, and that is the most important thing going on in the world in their mind. I'm not saying those are completely unimportant. I'm not saying that they don't deserve some airtime. But good gracious, can we please have some perspective? You're looking at a possible, I mean, granted, this is a bit of a stretch, but it is a possible outcome. You're looking at what people in Russia are considering the potential start of World War III. And you really want to spend half your newscast every day talking about Stormy Daniels and the other half talking about James Comey's new book? I mean, for the love of all that is good and holy, can we please have some priorities here? Again, I'm not saying that the other stuff deserves no airtime, that it can't be discussed. But the ridiculous amount of coverage that those stories have gotten, because the media is salivating at even the hint of that there might possibly theoretically be a chance that Donald Trump could be impeached, that they spend all their time on that. And I'm just sitting here like, do you people not have any sense whatsoever of the imminent danger that is in the world right now? It is frustrating. And as a member of the media myself, I'm just sitting here thinking, for goodness sake, please have some perspective on this. Let's put this in context and keep in mind what's really important. Because as salacious as it may be, as fun as it may be to talk about, as much as people get heated and get into debates about this, whether or not the former FBI director James Comey likes Trump or not is not going to affect your life that much. Whether or not the president had sex with a porn star, as sickening as the thought of that is, and as much as I do believe that she ought to be held accountable for that, does it really affect your life all that much? No. Being in a proxy war with Russia in Syria, or an open war with Russia, which is also, I think, an unlikely but still possible outcome of this, that's going to affect your life quite a bit. Gang, they ain't Afghanistan. They're not Iraq. We go to war with Russia? That's serious. That could affect every aspect of your life. And so I do really wish that the media could get it together and offer at least some accurate reporting on this, some sense of, I don't know, urgency when it comes to these issues. We're going to talk about this a little bit more and break down what is actually going on and how this plays out on the world stage in just a moment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440, that is the way you can get in touch with me and turn my monologue into a dialogue, have a conversation about what's going on right now. We always welcome that. You can also do that by means of Twitter, at Tactics Radio, if you want to tweet and see what is going on. Always welcome your comments. Now, getting back to what we were talking about, which is the situation in Syria right now, and with their, what's the best way to say this? I guess their backer, the godfather kind of running the operation in there is definitely Vladimir Putin. And because there is a issue there with getting involved in Syria means getting involved with Russia, I think that is the primary reason that the Trump administration has yet to act, yet to respond to what is going on over in Syria right now. And here's really where this goes to, or really where we are right now. We're currently building a coalition of us and then also the UK, France, and Germany. So a coalition has already been formed between these countries that are preparing to respond in some kind of meaningful military fashion against Russia, against Syria, and against Iran, because those are the three players that are involved with each other there in Syria. And because of that, and because they're all backing the Assad regime, they're kind of weighing their options right now, and they're putting together a coalition. Now, here's the thing. This is, I think, a good thing. I think it's good that we're consulting with our allies. I think it's good that we're building support. And I do think that it's positive that even though we could act unilaterally and would not be unjustified in acting unilaterally, that the president does see it as something that is beneficial and something that is positive to at least talk to our allies about it and not necessarily ask permission, but definitely try to get them on board ahead of time. I think that that is a good strategy to have. It's not, like I said, it's not necessary, but it is a good policy. And that's really where I stand on that. But we're building that coalition. And the other day, Putin actually called Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, to ask him not to join the coalition. He does not want Israel in that coalition, which makes sense. You don't want someone in that coalition that is that close to Syria geographically. And in response to this, and I love Benjamin Netanyahu, I think that he is one of the best world leaders on the world stage right now. Netanyahu responded by reading a statement just recently from Iran about the 12th Imam coming and about encircling Israel. And you have to understand a little bit of the context religiously to really get what Netanyahu is talking about. See, what Iran is trying to do now is they're trying to form a caliphate in the shape of a crescent, because that's the symbol for Muslim, it's the big symbol. It's kind of like the cross for Christians. It's the symbol for Muslims. And what they're trying to do is they're saying that the end is near. The 12th Imam is coming. The 12th Imam is kind of like what they're saying is the Revelation prophecy. It's their version of the apocalypse, where the 12th Imam comes back and the great war that ends the earth takes place. I'm probably butchering that, but that's the simple watered down explanation for what's happening. And so Iran, again, whether you believe this or not, it's what they believe. And they believe that the 12th Imam only comes when the world has been bathed in blood by Muslims. So the Twelvers, the people that believe this prophecy, they believe that it's going to take place, but they are actually trying to evoke it. They're trying to bring it about by killing people, by wiping Israel off of the map. And keep in mind, in Iran's actual official constitution, the destruction of the state of Israel and the Jewish people is literally a part of their constitution. So asking Netanyahu not to join this coalition, that was his response to it. So it appears as though, even though it's not official yet, we've heard no news about that, that it is something that Netanyahu is seriously considering, and he is probably in favor of joining this coalition, which he would be a welcome addition to it, standing against Putin and what's going on over there. But he called him and asked him not to join it, and that's really where it came from. So here's where we are right now. We're basically already in a proxy war with Russia. For all intents and purposes, we're already in a proxy war with Russia right now. And we have been for a while, because Russia backed the Assad regime. We were running guns to Syria, to Syrian rebels. We were arming them. By the way, hence Benghazi. That's part of the reason for the Benghazi cover-up. We found out later, this was confirmed a couple years after it happened, that actually in America we were running guns to Syria, to Syrian rebels, people that were opposed to the Assad regime. And a lot of that hardware wound up in the hands of ISIS, unfortunately, but that originally was part of what happened and part of the reason that we were worried about Benghazi being exposed. And part of the reason you saw the cover-up, part of the reason that there was not this rescue in Benghazi, that the troops and the Marines were ordered to stand down because they were afraid that this whole operation was going to expose that we were running guns to Syrians. And we were doing so in an attempt to very quietly take down Assad. And so Russia has been backing Assad. And so we've essentially been engaged in a proxy war with Russia and Syria already for a few years now. And unfortunately, a lot of the stupid policies that were enacted by the last administration wound up creating ISIS. A lot of that hardware, because we were giving them to people that, even though they were the enemy of our enemy, they were not good people and not people that we should trust, and eventually that wound up biting us in the backside. And so right now, we've essentially already been in a proxy war with Russia for a while. And this could become another proxy war, theoretically, with us backing Israel. I think that's the most likely scenario. I'm not saying that it couldn't lead to some kind of open conflict with us and Russia, but we've basically already been in a proxy war there for a while anyway. And I think either we wind up backing somebody that is more trustworthy like Israel, which, goodness knows, I don't want to be in a proxy war, but I would far more, if we're going to be in one anyway, far rather have Israel as our representative than a bunch of Syrian rebels. Because we all saw where that ended. At least Israel we can trust. At least they'll do the right thing, or at least they will do the best that they can to. And so, I think that that's a possible scenario, that what happens is we wind up engaged in a proxy war with Russia in Syria and basically have Israel as our representative. Israel is the force that we're backing. I don't know if that's going to happen. I could see that playing out, and I do think that that is a possible outcome. So there's a couple different things here. This could be another Cuban Missile Crisis where there's a lot of buildup, a lot of hype, and then eventually it winds up just kind of fizzling out and not going anywhere. Doesn't mean the Cuban Missile Crisis wasn't significant. Doesn't mean that it was not something that changed our relationship with Russia and it was something that was seen as a problem with the two of us. But the point is, it could wind up fizzling out like the Cuban Missile Crisis, or it could be the next Vietnam, a proxy war with another country in a neutral site, as it were. Not neutral, really, but neutral meaning that it doesn't happen on Russian soil or American soil. Or it could theoretically be the build-up to World War I, where all these little countries get into spats with one another. This isn't exactly like that because we have a beef directly with Syria as well. So it's not exactly the same thing, but tensions could ratchet up, and eventually, because America is fighting Syria and because Russia's backing Syria, then they want to be in a conflict with us. Again, I don't think that that's necessarily a super likely scenario, but it could happen, and we should take that possibility, even the possibility of it, very seriously. Before we go to the commercial break, why don't we take at least one call? Let's go to the phones. Good morning. What's your name?
Curtis.
Hey, Curtis. What's on your mind this morning?
Hey, I think some of the background that you're speaking of, which led to where we are today with regard to so many of these international situations, is absolutely spot on.
Well, thank you.
You're right. It's just so true that I think under President Obama, and the world eventually learned this, and Europe learned it, they were so enamored with the thought of this cerebral, nice guy coming in. And he that was nice in the beginning, and he got his Nobel Prize for doing nothing. But as time went on, he was perceived as a Mr. Rogers, a weak sister in everything, and they lost the world lost respect for us.
Well, and that's the problem, really, that what they wound up doing is, and Syria was a part of this, they wound up testing the waters with Obama, and after just a few big trials, they realized, well, he's really not going to do anything, regardless of what we do.
Exactly.
And because of that, they started steamrolling over him. They knew that they could get away with pretty much anything, and did. And remember that it was Obama that, when the first chemical attack in Syria happened, that he backed off and who came in to fix the problem and ensure that Syria didn't have any more chemical weapons, it was Vladimir Putin. And we see the results of that. Now Russia is involved. They're in Syria. They're well established. They've got military over there. A lot of this mess, in fact, I would say the vast majority of this mess happened because Obama refused to take any action when there was a justifiable reason to take action initially.
Exactly. And again, the luster went off him as time went by because everybody was so euphoric. Oh, you know, he's a black guy and he's professorial and, you know, likable. But again, he was just so weak-kneed. And over time, they just lost respect for him and said, hey, we can push him around and we can push America around. So I think that's why we're in the predicament. So I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, thank you very much, Curtis. I appreciate it. Have a good day. Yeah, and that's part of the problem that when it comes to all of this, Europe really liked Obama because he was this progressive guy. He was very European in a lot of senses. He probably would have been a very successful European politician. He's a likable guy. I've never said that Obama isn't likable. I don't like him, but personality-wise, I mean, you could see him being somebody that you'd want to hang out with, somebody that you could kind of see being your neighbor or something like that. And so that was a good quality that Obama had. But here's the thing. You can be the most likable person in the world and still be bad at your job. A great example, look at Ronald Reagan. That's an example of someone who is likable. He was personable. He could speak to the American people in a way that they would respond positively. But he also, people knew you don't mess with Reagan. Because if people had done this when Reagan was in office, you can bet there would be a pretty strong response. And I hope there is this time. But the point in all that is, you can be likable, you can be somebody that people can respect, and also somebody that people can genuinely have some affection for. But when it came to Obama, a lot of the poor decisions that were made in his administration to avoid war at all cost, and to stay out of things, and to do this leading from behind garbage that he came up with, we're seeing the results of that now. I mean, we were seeing the results of it back when he was president, too. But this especially, a lot of this could have been avoided if we had just taken a somewhat stronger stance, even if military action wasn't actually taken, if the threat of military action was there and people on the world stage believed, oh, he's actually going to do it. He might actually pull this off. That's one of the things that even though I don't like how bombastic Trump is, I don't like the way that he talks about conflict. I don't like that he makes these somewhat schoolyard-like remarks when it comes to the military. You know, it's almost the my dad can beat up your dad, my military can beat up your military mentality, which even though I don't like some of that bravado, I prefer a more quiet threat. The one thing that I can say about Trump on this is people believe that he'll actually do it. People believe he'll actually take the steps to do what is necessary and that if you push him, he is going to respond. That is a good quality in a president. And that's something that I can, you know, give a lot of props to Trump on. That is something that he has done that is radically different from the Obama administration. And we're already seeing that with some of the responses with the way Putin's reacted to this, that does affect how they react to situations like this. Because they believe that Trump might just actually be crazy enough to give the order. And that's something that I do think acts as a deterrent and is actually a good thing for us on the world stage. 860-1440, if you disagree, if you want to talk to me about it, we'll be right back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We all agree in the obligation of the moral principles of Jesus, and nowhere will they be found delivered in greater purity than in his discourses. Thomas Jefferson.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, those are the numbers. If you do want to call in, let me know what is on your mind. And speaking of Thomas Jefferson, today is his birthday. So happy birthday, President Jefferson. Certainly glad that he has been a part of our country, one of our most inspiring founders. He is the man, of course, who wrote the words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." I mean, I could go on, but you get the idea. Thomas Jefferson, thank you for everything that you did for our country. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your inspiring words. One of the most intelligent men to ever hold the White House, just intellectually wise. I mean, the guy was a doctor, inventor. There's just, he is by far one of the most intelligent men I think that has ever lived. If you're looking at the way that he had such a mechanical mindset, he was very pragmatic. And I mean, was just a real student of science and politics. As he spoke four different languages. He actually released, people talk about the Jefferson Bible. There were actually two Jefferson Bibles. And that's something that a lot of people don't understand, that there are actually two different Jefferson Bibles. And one of them was just a study on the miracles of Jesus. So it basically, he just took only the miracles, or sorry, the opposite, the teachings of Jesus. So he took only the dialogue, left out the miracles, left out a lot of the events, the actual narrative part of the Gospels, and just left in the teaching moments, the discourses of Jesus. And he did that as a way to evangelize Native Americans. And that was basically, he wanted to very much focus on just the discourses, just the teachings of Jesus, to give them kind of the basics. And then the miracles and narratives of their life, he believed that should come later. But he wrote that Jefferson Bible, and then he wrote another one that he issued to members of Congress for their own personal use and study, because he felt that that was something important for the members of Congress to be aware of. And this particular Bible that he wrote was written in four different languages side by side to give a comparison. And Jefferson didn't have a translator. He translated it. He was his own translator because he spoke all four of those languages. I mean, just absolutely a remarkable man. No shortage of accomplishments by one of our most important founders. And really what he epitomized when he did take office, and I love this quote by him, that when he took office, he said, "We have just experienced a bloodless revolution." Because keep in mind that Jefferson did not belong to the same political party as John Adams and George Washington. And so when his administration came in, that was a proud moment for our country, because it was a time that there was what he was referring to is there was a revolution, there was a change in thought, there was a change in administrations, and one that took place without bloodshed, without a revolution in the sense, because back in the past, keep in mind, this was the time of monarchs. If you wanted to change the leadership of your country, there was only one way to do it. War. Overthrow it. But Jefferson, and he was right to talk about the significance of the event of him being elected president, that the American people said, you know what, we need to go in a different direction. And they were able to do that without uprising, without killing their neighbors and killing their countrymen. It was really a great day for mankind as a whole, and Jefferson realized that. And I could literally do a whole week of shows just on Jefferson. But I wanted to talk about this because I think one of his greatest quotes is one that isn't talked about often. And I think I tell people, when people ask, what is your political philosophy? Because it's hard to pin me down exactly. And I think that is because I've studied so much and taken ideas from so many different sources. And I think that anybody that has really studied politics, it's hard to fit them in a nice, neat little box. So I don't think it's just me because I'm special or whatever. I think this is true of a lot of people that are involved in politics and have really studied some of this stuff, that it's hard to put them in one particular box and explain them in just a few words. So I tell people, and it's kind of like the return that I have, I'm kind of a libertarian, but more of a constitutionalist. So you could kind of say I'm kind of like a 1970s Federalist. And I know that all sounds convoluted, but I say, if you want to sum up my political philosophy in one word, I think you can take a line out of Jefferson's inaugural address, where he says, "The wise and frugal government shall not take from the mouth of the laborer the bread which it has earned." And that also he continues on and says that a government shall do its best to keep men from injuring one another and otherwise leave them to their own devices. Now, that's a paraphrase, but that's the spirit of what he's saying, because I don't have it in front of me. And it's kind of lengthy. But in his inaugural address, that's basically what he says, that the government does not take from people that which they have labored for. And on top of that, that the best government is the one that will keep you from hurting each other. But pretty much other than that, as long as you're not violating somebody else's rights, the government should be staying out of your life as much as possible. That was Jefferson's idea. And we see this reflected in his political stances over and over again. A lot of people don't know this, but I think this is a really big deal, and this is something that ought to be seen as something more more profound in the events of Thomas Jefferson's life. Do you know that when the, I've talked about this many times on the air, when the Constitution was written and you had the First Amendment written that kept Congress from creating an establishment of religion, part of the reason that that was the case and that was written is that they didn't want the federal government infringing upon the right of a state to establish a state religion if they wanted to. Because there were four states at the time, and they remained the official religions of those states for quite some time, that the individual states, four of them, had an official state religion. Had the Constitution been passed just a few years earlier, there would have been five. Because Jefferson worked to get his own home state of Virginia out of the business of deciding religion. And he founded a university, the University of Virginia, that was meant to be a multi-denominational institution, the first of its kind, because back then all universities had some kind of affiliation with a church. And people have unfortunately mistaken this to mean that he was not religious, which is not the truth at all. When he created his institution, he specifically put spaces and different parts of the university in a way that people of all denominations, faiths, and backgrounds could come onto his campus and argue and talk about religion. So he was not trying to push religion out of the public sphere. In fact, he did the exact opposite. He created a university where people could exchange ideas, could exchange thoughts, and do so freely and not worry about, you know, getting kicked out of the college or whatever because they had a belief that was different than the church doctrine of the church that was running the school. He wanted a school that wasn't affiliated with a particular church, so that there could be this free exchange of ideas. And was also an advocate of freedom of religion when it came to his own home state as well. He was one of the ones leading the charge that got Virginia to eventually no longer have a state religion. And like I said, I could go on for days and days and days about Jefferson, but just an amazing man, and so glad that he was born and we celebrate his birthday today. So thank you, President Jefferson. Chaplain's Report is coming up.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440. Those are the numbers if you want to get in touch with me. But we do have the Chaplain's Report. And I did want to bring this up real quick. This comes from Proverbs 9 through 7. Chapter 9, verse 7. He says, "Who corrects a scoffer gets dishonor for himself, and he who reproves a wicked man gets insults for himself." One of the things that he's talking about here is not that it is never useful to talk about correcting a scoffer, correcting somebody that has it wrong. But if you read in the very next verse, he gives a contrast here where he's talking about this in verse 7. And so in verse 8, he says, "Do not reprove a scoffer or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man and he will love you." So he's not saying don't reprove people. He's not saying don't rebuke someone when they are in the wrong. What he is saying here is he's giving a contrast between the reaction of someone who seeks knowledge, who wants to be better, who wants to be improved, who wants somebody to call them out when they get something wrong, because it's important to them to have the truth. It's important for them to find that which is right and that which is not. And he's contrasting that, a wise man who will love someone for reproving him, for bringing up an error that has been made, versus somebody who is foolish, who is unwise, who is just going to lash out. And we've all known people like that, that even if you're trying to help, even if you're trying to be constructive, even if you're doing the very best you can to be amicable, be somebody who is friendly and likable, and you're doing it in the best possible way, you're just doing it because you're concerned out of them, even then, he's saying, there are a lot of people are foolish people, and they're going to be upset with you. They're going to hate you just for calling out an error, even if you're doing it in the best possible way and in the best possible intention. But a wise person is someone who will love you for pointing that out, and so that they can correct themselves and better themselves. And so the lesson here is, really, we should do the best that we can to be like the wise man who loves reproval, who loves somebody pointing this out, because we really are people that honestly are seeking out truth. That's who God wants his people to be. Stay the course, friends.
And keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.